Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is January 28th, 2026, and my guest is philosopher and author Hanno Sauer. His latest book and the subject of today's episode is The Invention of Good and Evil, A World History of Morality. Hanno, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thanks for the invite, Russ.
Now, your book opens. This is a sprawling book. It is full of interesting ideas, and it covers an enormous span of human history and human behavior. So we're going to do the best we can to get at some of the ideas in the book. You open with a passage that reminded me very much of Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments. The first sentence of Smith's is, "How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it." And much of that book is trying to answer the questions, why do we ever do anything that is not self-interested? I would not say unselfish. I don't like that phrasing. But Smith starts with the idea that we're self-interested. So why do we ever do anything that even looks altruistic? Your book starts with the following. Or not starts, but early on, the fact that cooperation, the fact that cooperation is unlikely, can be formulated as an explanatory problem in evolutionary theory. How did evolution manage to create altruistic or cooperative tendencies, even though apparently, at any rate, these tendencies inevitably reduce our reproductive fitness? How could it ever be beneficial for me to help someone else? How could it ever be worth subordinating my self-interest for the well-being of the community?
Yeah.
So take a crack at your book, in some sense, is trying to answer that whole question. So it's a long answer, but give us the short answer.
Yeah, you're right. Adam Smith, I greatly appreciate him. Fantastic writer, philosopher. More and more he gets, I think, also recognized as a philosopher again. And of course, his economic contribution is, you know, without a doubt, first rate. So I enjoy that comparison. And you're right, at the most abstract and general level, one way of putting it would be that I try to deal with a kind of reverse theodicy problem. So when you think about it, in pre-Darwinian times, when you have a theistic framework, a theistic outlook on the world, you get a theodicy problem. You kind of need to explain how evil and suffering come into the world if you have a deity that is all kind and all powerful and knows everything, right? So how do you square these three classical features of this divine entity with the fact that there are children dying early and there are wars and genocides and torture and so on and so on?
Earthquakes.
And now, that's right, yeah. And now, you get the opposite problem when you move to a naturalistic Darwinian framework. All of a sudden, the default assumption seems to be that it's nature red in tooth and claw, right? It's dog eat dog, it's elbows out, everyone is selfish, everyone is essentially sociopathic, right? Yeah. And now you get the problem, okay, evidently there is friendship and heroism and love and altruism and sacrifice. Well, where do those come from, right? It seems to not make any sense, but people like Adam Smith noticed this tension as well, and many others did. Evidently, such things do exist. So we have, on the one hand, we do have selfish and antisocial and uncooperative instincts and drives and inclinations, but clearly we also have the opposite. We also have friendship and altruism and morality and nice and cooperative and generous dispositions. Where do they come from? And I think, interestingly, we haven't really figured out a good, solid, and precise answer until well into the second half of the 20th century, where people started to understand evolutionary biologists equipped with game theory in tandem with economists, indeed. Sometimes these people were one and the same. Figured out where do the returns from cooperative behavior come from? And people started talking about inclusive fitness, and we started to understand reciprocity and how cooperation can get off the ground in a Darwinian world that in principle is morally indifferent and doesn't follow any divine design or any plan.
And those efforts, which include making the observation that, well, your genes are what, as Dawkins points out, your genes are what are driving this. If your brother shares your genes, you will maybe, it might be genetically valuable to make a sacrifice to save your brother, even though you might lose your own life, or your cousin, if the gains are large enough, or multiple cousins and so on. But what I liked about your treatment of this, and much of the book has this flavor that's interesting, it's helpful. It's not quite the whole story, though. And why not? And what do you go on to posit as the fuller explanation?
So you're right. So it's one thing to find out or to figure out why cooperation is an explanatory problem in the first place. But then you get another set of problems that are sort of specific to human beings, because we are indeed somewhat unusual in the animal kingdom, because we do cooperate and we thrive under conditions of cooperation. And we are, in fact, especially good at cooperating in our own way. But what we do is curious and unique. Namely, we have managed over the past years, decades, centuries, millennia, hundreds of thousands, and even millions of years in a way, now we're talking about proto-human, pre-human beings, we have managed to scale up our cooperation in a way that other animals don't do. So we have chimpanzees, and they live in cooperative small groups of maybe a few dozen individuals, but they never build societies of thousands of individuals or millions. In fact, it would be a kind of science fiction horror story, it would be uncanny to see millions of chimpanzees cooperate, right? Because we know they don't do that. Now, there are some animals that engage in large-scale cooperation, for instance, certain insects, termites, ants, and so on, but also they always do just that, right? So they have a specific sort of genetic programming, and they live one way and not any other way. But human beings have this malleability and plasticity and capability to live in all sorts of ways. We can, and sometimes, occasionally we still do, even nowadays, live in very, very small hunter-gatherer groups. And also we live in the society that you and me live in. We talk, across thousands of miles with modern technology, and we use trade that spans continents and so on and so on. So the society that we are part of essentially has billions of members, right, who cooperate on the basis of institutions and norms and social practice and so on and so on. And only we can really do that. And so the book that I've written is essentially a story of how we manage to expand our institutional toolkit to scale up human cooperation from very small groups to contemporary times with billions of people cooperating, sometimes inadvertently or not even knowingly, but we do in fact cooperate with people from Egypt and Taiwan.
So what are the evolutionary pressures that created that unusual result for human beings as opposed to other animals?
I mean, obviously there isn't just one. But I try to narrate this story of the various mechanisms that we use to scale up cooperation. So you can think of it as groups grow in size from very small, largely genetically related people that interact face to face almost every day, know each other very well, and occasionally meet other groups that they are distinct from and that may be somewhat hostile. It may be unremarkable, but we're talking about small groups. But the larger these groups become, you need to introduce new mechanisms to stabilize cooperation, which becomes increasingly fragile the more people you have. It becomes more entropic, so to speak, when you have more members in a group. Just think about a camping trip that you do with like six people in your family, and compare that to a camping trip with 60 or 600 people. You see, you need complete different solutions regarding division of labor, enforcement of norms, who gets up in the morning and when, who takes care of the kids, who's cleaning the pots, who's doing the fishing, who's building the tents, who's repairing the tools, and so on and so on. And so you need to figure all that out. And after a while, maybe the people who are supposed to clean the pots and repair the tools, they say, I don't feel like it today. And cooperation tends to unravel when this happens, right? So you need enforcement mechanisms. And so I dedicate a whole chapter to this idea of enforcement, social sanctions, from softer sanctions, such as telling people off, gossip, to all the way to capital punishment, and the way that this plays a role in the so-called self-domestication of humans. So we are kind of the golden retriever in the primate kingdom, right? So think about how golden retrievers relate to wolves, and that's how we relate to chimpanzees and gorillas, right? Very docile, kind of peaceful, at least towards the in-group, very non-conformist, very eager to learn, to play, relatively low aggression, at least impulsive aggression, and so on and so on. And we have become that way. Well, the question is, how did we become this way? And I think the story that is best supported by the evidence and also some theoretical considerations is that we just killed the most aggressive members of our tribes and bands for hundreds of thousands of years. So you get a kind of very, very intense selection pressure on human groups, where if you take out the 10% of the most violent people each generation, you're going to become less violent, right? Because if you take out all the wannabe bullies and tyrants before they get to reproduce, those genes are going to, tend to disappear from the population. And that sort of happened. And that is another mechanism, that the self-domestication mechanism is another way for us to stabilize cooperation and to do the next step in scaling up our group size.
Yeah, I love that idea of the self-domestication and the role of punishment, although it's a little hard to believe. We're not a docile species. And I think about sometimes a different version of how we, through our own actions, changed our gene pool, which is in early days, the alpha males had lots of wives, mates, I'll call them, as a better term. And those who couldn't find a mate would launch off into territories unknown. Consider the caricature would be a Viking. You get in your boat with a group of other dissatisfied men, and you go conquer something, and you come back with treasure, and you earn some mates that way. Mm-hmm. And we are in some dimension, I suppose, maybe the descendants of both of those groups. The people who remained after the bullies were killed, and the descendants of people who had the taste for risk, danger, and violence, maybe they're the ones who escaped the punishment and got out of town and came back later. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that as another story?
Well, I think this also happened. We know that humans can be very violent as well. They can coordinate on violence. They can form ad hoc coalitions. They can practice violent cooperation in hunting, which is it's very similar to, ambushing and raiding a different tribe. I believe that's what, primordial warfare is mostly supposed to have been, is sort of like raids, right? Nightly raids. So you don't really have we're going to meet warlike in an open field engage in combat like that. It was mostly, and we take what we can get, and we take as many women as we can get. And so there's probably, that has left some mark on our genetic makeup as well. And then the question would be like, which of these processes is maybe swamped the other? And so either way, this self-domestication dynamic would be something that applies more to the in-group, to the group itself. And these violent tendencies would largely remain directed at the out-group. And that is indeed another factor in our moral psychology, is that we inherited this strong us and them cognition.
But as you point out, a lot of times these urges are not, confined to the places they were first directed to. So
yeah.
You have a great line, great two lines here. Quote, one of humanity's greatest moral developments was delighting in cruelty. It was all the more difficult to unlearn this lust for cruelty after it had fulfilled its purpose. Explain those two sentences. Why would it be a great moral development to delight in cruelty?
Well, if you have an increasing need to enforce social norms, and sometimes you need violence, it just helps to kind of install a disposition for people to enjoy violence, right? Just like if you want to get people to reproduce, it makes sense to have people enjoy that, right? And that is not a justification for being violent today. It's just under certain circumstances that can be an asset. And later on, once you have solved the problem, as it were, that you were going to solve with this taste for violence, it can be that it becomes a kind of evolutionary hangover, right? So we still have it in our psyche, but now it's impractical and we are too violent and too harsh and too punitive. And I think that is what we see sometimes, that in contemporary societies and in modern societies, it is sometimes possible to need very little violence to enforce cooperation for various reasons. But it's still possible for that instinct, for that atavistic instinct, to flare up. And when an egregious crime happens that's very, very salient, perhaps in the public, people get this taste for punitive reaction. It's understandable, but at the same time, it's useful to know where that comes from and when it may or may not be appropriate.
Yeah, but your claim, which is, I think, an unusual claim, is that the source of that, what you call a lust for cruelty, or we could also call it a psychopath has this lust for cruelty. You argue that it is the evolutionary hangover of a positive impulse, which is to really put it in economics language, the punishment for free riding. People who exploit for their own benefit whatever the group is doing and cheat on the agreement or on the norms has to be punished. It's interesting. You can punish them by expulsion. You can punish them by social exclusion, social isolation. But mm-hmm. none of those are as effective as violence. And in fact, of course, as you point out, sometimes there's a leader who doesn't just free ride, that person becomes a tyrant over the group.
Yeah.
In which case, a group of people take the tyrant down. Brutus and his friends take down mm-hmm. Julius Caesar, and that's it's that need for that punishment mechanism, mm-hmm. that way to reduce free riding and tyranny.
Yeah.
That has a negative externality in our behavior. In other areas.
That's right. That's right. I fully agree with that description. And the reason I describe it as, well, some things can be moral improvements or moral changes that for the time, at a certain point in time, constitute a moral improvement, even though looking at them from today's perspective, we would also view them as something unpleasant and at least ambivalent. And I think the evolution of punishment and cruelty is a little bit like that, where it was kind of like a ladder we needed to get on the roof, and now we want to kick the ladder away. It has that kind of thing about it, or kind of feel about it. The very general point is that as human groups become larger, the need for enforcement of norms increases. We know from experimental studies, economics games, public goods games, for instance, that people start with, in the first couple of rounds, one or two rounds, with cooperation, and then cooperation unravels. So when you do these experiments with a punishment option, you see that cooperation can be stabilized. Now, that's not, you know, the first best way that we would like humans to be, but that's the way it is, right? Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made, and social sanctions are one of the ways to straighten out the crooked timber of humanity. And it still works today. It makes sense to think about also, you know, to engage in cost-benefit analysis of how punitive we need to be. And I think we often overlook that because our psychology isn't really cost-benefit psychology, as to the great chagrin of economists who keep reminding people of trade-offs and hidden costs, right? It's one of the big frustrations that economists have with the general public is that they only see benefits or they only see costs and so on and so on, and they just completely omit and ignore one side of the equation. So we should engage in cost-benefit thinking when it comes to punishment and our punitive instincts and social sanctions. But they did play that role in the past, and they still continue to play that role today. And I don't think we could really do without any social sanctions. We tend to need some mix of incentives and sanctions, of course, and ideally more incentives and fewer sanctions, and ideally the sanctions aren't too harsh. But in principle, collective action problems remain present, and they always threaten to undermine social cooperation. And so you need some sort of enforcement.
Yeah, just to criticize economists a little bit, I think...
Go ahead.
Well, easy for me, right? I'll do the dirty work for you. Although you may not agree with this... Gary Becker, who happened to be my advisor, mm-hmm. in his Economics of Crime and Punishment, if I remember correctly, advocated often for a mm-hmm. large punishment with a small probability of being caught, because arguing that the expected value of the punishment is what would have an impact. And by having a low probability of being caught, you could reduce the cost of monitoring and enforcement. So you could mm-hmm. have a relatively small police force, as long as sometimes when people got caught, they would pay this huge price, and then mm-hmm. the expected cost would be sufficient to deter future crime. And mm-hmm. I would argue, and I've argued somewhere on this program and years ago, that morally that's very disturbing to most people, because it means that a handful of the criminals, they're all guilty in theory. Of course, that's mm-hmm. not. That's part of the problem, is that they're not all guilty, the ones you impose the punishment on. Yeah. But even if they are all guilty, you're imposing a large punishment way above probably the crime to make sure that the expected value deters mm-hmm. the other criminals. And that offends our sense of justice, even if it's, quote, mm-hmm. efficient. It's deeply disturbing, I think, to human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a nice. So I like this way of thinking. I just disagree with this specific point, but because I think this. So I may not be 100% up to date on this topic, but but last time I looked at the evidence,
I know I'm definitely not up to date. So go ahead. Okay. It's okay. Go for right. it.
So then I'm just leaving it to the audience to look it up. But my read of the evidence right now is that in terms of making deterrence and the threat of punishment actually effective in deterring unwanted antisocial behavior, it's the opposite. So it seems to be motivationally the most effective when people are quite certain that they get caught, even when the punishment is not as harsh. So you can tell people, so if you have a society where you rob someone and there is a 90% chance you're going to get flogged, right? People find that very motivationally disincentivizing, and if they have an extremely harsh punishment, such as they're going to get drawn and quartered in the town square, but it almost never happens. People think they're going to get away with it, yeah. right? And apparently, this would make sense because there is a kind of selection effect of people who self-select into criminal careers. They tend to not be very, very prudent right?
That is good a probability for sure. You'd
right.
Think,
so
maybe.
Yeah. So I suppose that you and I don't tend to contemplate the pros and cons of bank robbery very often, right? It's just not a thing that some, but so the kind of person that contemplates seriously whether or not to rob a bank may not be the one that is most susceptible to the kind of cost benefit analysis that Gary Becker recommended. So it's a little bit of a kind of, it's the kind of punishment that would work on economists with an IQ of 145, right? but not on the people that you want to deter.
Yeah.
So, but I like that idea. I like that way you're thinking. I remember that there is an example that Gordon Tullock gives at some point where he says, if you want to increase road safety, don't install airbags. You should install a sharp dagger into the steering wheel.
Yeah.
Right. That's going to increase safety. And it's just so counterintuitive. And as you said, it's upsetting to most people to think that way. But I like that way. I like that way of thinking, if only because it's contrarian and it cracks something open. I like that.
It's a perfect Gordon Tullock example. Yeah. He delighted in that kind of provocative example.
Yeah.
But of course, the problem with that is yes, if there were a spike in the car or a dagger, you'd drive very slowly, very cautiously, but more likely you wouldn't drive at all. But that highlights what the costs are of excessive punishment.
Exactly. Exactly.
Before we leave this, I want to, I know my listeners are eager to hear me say that, quoting Smith, man naturally desires not only to be loved, but to be lovely. That is, we are hardwired to care about what other people think of us. Mm-hmm. But we also want to be actually good and praiseworthy, not just praised, not just honored, but honorable.
Yeah.
But you're right. I love this. The exchange of gossip and rumors has played an important part in revolutionary history, especially for the evolution of language, whose original function may primarily have been social communication about other people's behavior. And of course, Smith, that's very Smithian, right? The way we care about our reputation, we care about what other people think about us and what they say about us. And that's an amazing thing. And it could be true about language.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that we do not just desire to be loved, but to be worthy of love, right? To be lovely. Now, I think in the vast majority of cases, these things are sort of almost identical because the best way to be loved is to be lovely. Right. So the best way to seem good is to just be good. Right. If you want to just sort of aim at seeming good straight without the detour through being good. This is a little bit like the paradox of hedonism. Right. If you aim for fun directly, you know, you're going to miss it. Right. Fun needs to happen.
Yeah.
At your behavior. Right. So there's a kind of paradox of being moral, which is that if you aim at seeming moral, if you aim at seeming moral directly, there's also going to be, you're going to come off as calculative and manipulative, right? And just keeping up appearances. And if you just go for, you know, just authentically caring about people, you're going to seem moral, and that's going to be something that people appreciate much more. I think the process of evolution is smart in that way, in that it has equipped us with these abilities to be motivated in ways that feel authentic to us, and that are authentic, right? That we genuinely care about friends, we genuinely care about people we love, we genuinely care about our kids, or whatever group that we identify with, you know, the tennis club or the nation or the tribe or whatever. This is not fake. But of course, underlying it, distally speaking, there is a strategic rationale that led to the evolution of these tendencies that have become authentically experienced in our minds. So it's sort of both. You have an underlying strategic rationale for the evolution of authentically felt dispositions of virtue. The great primatologist Frans de Waal, Dutch primatologist, once said that he's an advocate of this so-called veneer theory of morality, right? He has this great line. I think it's false, but it's a great line. Watch an altruist, scratch an altruist and watch a hypocrite bleed. And the idea is that, you know, altruism is skin deep.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's really true. I think our altruistic and cooperative dispositions, they go pretty deep, even though it is, of course, correct. There is a selfish gene kind of rationale underlying them.
But it's like you suggest, if it's authentic, it's a much more effective signal than if it's fake.
Yeah.
And I always like the example of Herb Kelleher when he was CEO of Southwest Airlines on Christmas and Thanksgiving would go work the baggage claim and to be with the workers who his mm-hmm. workers. And mm-hmm. it was a tremendous stunt. And he claimed, as far as I know, that they never publicized it much. Of course, we know about it, but it wasn't, mm-hmm. they didn't tell reporters to show up, which is something he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered, it's a very powerful mm-hmm. cultural benefit for his company. So his workers knew that he was on their side.
Yeah.
And I always asked, you know, why didn't other airline CEOs do this? And the answer would be, I thought it was pretty simple. They wouldn't enjoy it and they'd have to pretend they were enjoying it. I think Herb mm-hmm. actually enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. He was a very down-to-earth guy. He was not a pretentious yeah. guy. Mm-hmm. And the idea of, I'm sure there were times he'd rather be with his family, but doing manual labor with his workers was fun for him. It wasn't yeah. a stunt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It can also help to be a CEO that used to, you know, start at the very bottom in the company, yeah. right, where you really Correct. Know the ropes.
Yeah.
So if you actually used to do that 45 years ago, it's going to be much more believable, you know, the culture, you know, how people talk, you know, the movements and so on and so on. And then that's going to be a huge plus for your credibility in the business. I once heard a story about someone who was walking around London late at night, kind of 11 o'clock or something. And there was this famous, you know, world famous chef. There was many restaurants in London. And he was getting out of a black SUV in full kitchen garment to only to sort of like walk through the back door and then greet the guests as if he had been in the kitchen. And then he would go back into the SUV and go to the next restaurant. And so once you hear that kind of story is really off-putting to people, right?
Sure.
Because people absolutely hate that kind of mimicry.
Yeah.
And we are very, very sensitive towards deception and people trying to manipulate us with the signals that they send. And when yeah. they do it so strategically, people absolutely hate that.
And before we leave, Smith, I want to get your reaction to something you didn't talk about, but put in a Smithian context. So Smith mm-hmm. is very, very eager not to invoke religious upbringing mm-hmm. as an explanation for good behavior. He does have a role for the author of nature, I think he calls God. But so mm-hmm. he argues well into the book that God put this desire to judge others in us mm-hmm. as a way to monitor free riding. Doesn't put it like in that those terms, but that's the gist
yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
But what was interesting to me is that now you're not a believer. I'm pretty clear. I'm pretty confident.
That's right.
And you don't invoke the divine other than to talk about the change in culture that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
But for believers and some others, and you can include, I guess you could include Nietzsche in this list or Dostoevsky for sure,
mm-hmm.
that religion plays an important role in constraining behavior in modern times,
yeah.
Meaning post-1500 or modern era, generally broadly defined. And so, you know, without God, everything is allowed, is the quote. You don't talk about that. Do you have any anything to say about the human belief, which mm-hmm. you don't accept, but the human belief that some morality is divinely revealed?
Okay, so I'll try to give a nuanced answer this question. I do think that religion is very important in the biological and cultural and social evolution of human society, cooperation, and morality. But I say that as an outside observer. So I do not think that that's the case because morality gets some or all of its authority from divine command, because I do not believe there is such a thing. And I do not think that morality can only have authority over human behavior if there were such a thing as a divine entity asking us to behave a certain way. So I do not think that without God, everything is allowed. I think we can ground morality in human level considerations. We don't need transcendent justification or backing or foundations to do that. At any rate, I would always want to know, why should I accept the verdict or wishes of the divine entity then, if there were one? These are sort of the classical objections to a theistic validation of moral norms. But I do think that religion is very important, not just in constraining moral behavior, but also it's kind of cheesecake for some of our moral instincts, right? So it activates some of our moral instincts. And religion, in the most abstract level, famously, there can be religions without God, without a deity like the Abrahamic religions would know it. But religion, first and foremost, sociologically speaking, I think what it does is that it practices ritual and respect for authority and cohesion of a group. So when you think about, I don't know if you've been to one, but like a Catholic, I've been to, I guess, one or two in my life as a witness, to a Catholic mass. It's singing, it's ritual, it's very regimented, it's very structured. It has very, very clear symbolic affirmation of roles, who's the boss, who gets to call the shots, if I may say so. And I think it practices, you know, awe, respect for higher values, yeah, and sure, authority, and it practices ritual. That's why there's a lot of singing, there's lots of praying is a kind of, we are in sync. Yeah. Kind of activity, right? There, obviously, what is it called? Isolated prayer is like, you know, lone prayer, I suppose. Yeah. But I think first and foremost, it's a social activity that you then sometimes enact privately in your room. So that's the sort of conducive way in which religion or a taste for transcendent forces such as authority and the group inculcates in us a sense that can then be harnessed for the sake of cooperation in general. And likewise, you have very, very interesting, very recent studies and contributions in theories of cultural evolution, which notice that you almost always see the co-evolution of early urbanization and empires together with what these people call big gods, right? So in many sort of small-scale societies, you have a bunch of gods. Even the Greeks still had a bunch of gods with like different roles, right? One was for war, one was for science, one was for the arts, one was the, you know, big guy. This strikes us as a kind of infantile way of thinking, right? At least that's how it always seemed to me. These are great stories, right? Where you have Zeus and Poseidon battling. But it's great. You don't really believe that. I don't really believe in Odin and Thor. I assume you don't either, but these are great stories, right? And at a certain point in time, around couple thousand years ago, in different places, but largely in Mesopotamia, so the Middle East, basically, you see these big gods, big moralistic gods, and they are larger than life. First of all, it sort of tends to gravitate towards one god, right, who does everything. And you don't have these goofy nature gods, the river god and the forest god or whatever, right? But one huge god who gets in, it becomes increasingly powerful, right? Until you have this idea that it's an otherworldly creature that knows everything, can do everything, and so on and so on. And the reason is that as societies, again, scale up and become larger, you have cities that maybe have 50,000 inhabitants, right? In Iraq or in what used to be Persia or something, you know, that kind of region. And you can't monitor people's behavior, right? It becomes easier and easier to get away with antisocial behavior. So then it becomes very, very useful to have a cultural invention where you tell people, oh, by the way, we have bad news. You're not getting away with anything because God sees everything and God knows your thoughts and your wickedness. And in fact, this divine entity doesn't just know everything you do, but here's another piece of bad news. Namely, you get to live after you die, and so you can be punished, in whatever the construct then is, purgatory or hell or some sort of conception of continued existence of the mind that can be subject to retaliation or punishment even after you're dead. And that becomes a very, very powerful idea. So in that sense, I think religion is very important for human morality and cooperation, even though I personally say this as someone who is not a person of faith, but just looks at it from a theoretical and empirical standpoint.
So I'm a person of some faith, and I take religion seriously. But I want to put that into your story in a different way and see how you if you like this. So your early story of morality, and we've touched on it here. Your book spends much more time on it, and readers, listeners can go read the book if they want to learn more about the evolutionary story, but. Uh-huh. The evolutionary story is fundamentally cooperation is in your self-interest, because if you don't cooperate, you can be punished. And you will find that if you do cooperate, everybody's better off, the group thrives. And so it has a somewhat of a self-reinforcing mechanism through those results. Mm-hmm. But that's not quite the same. Cooperating versus free riding is not quite the same as good and evil. It's not quite the same, which has a should connotation. The story of morality that you're telling is a self, in some dimension, a self-interest story. So is the religious one, of course, because God's going to reward you. But with the revelation of divine morality, certainly in the Abrahamic religions, you have this idea of should and what one ought to do. And in theory, that's necessary for the more, again, I'm being very pragmatic here and not talking about faith. That should be a very powerful incentive/motivator for when you find yourself in much more complex social situations. I'm talking about cheating on your taxes, underweighing your goods with a trading partner. These aren't just about cooperating versus not cooperating. This is about nuances of what it means to be a quote good person. And I think here's the challenge. I think for your view about the role of religion. A lot of people these days, they could be wrong, but they're starting to wonder whether the decline in religiosity is having a social consequence that's quite serious, because the evolutionary underpinning is not sufficient in the 21st century. And the role of religion, which built up all these muscles and cultural effects, is dying for many people. And we're dealing with the consequences. I'm thinking about Jonathan Rauch, who I interviewed last year, about his book on the importance of Christianity to American democracy. Even Richard Dawkins, maybe the most famous atheist alive now that Christopher Hitchens is dead. Richard Dawkins, you can say there were three, Dawkins, Harrison, Sam Harrison, and Hitchens. Dawkins says, Christianity has an important cultural role to play. And then we have Ayaan Hirsch Ali, who converted to Christianity, wasn't quite sure. It wasn't a conversion of faith as much as it was a conversion of cultural necessity, in her view.
Yeah.
So react to that.
I think These are all very interesting questions, and I think I'm happy to, I'm not against any possible answer, whatever the truth is.
Yeah, me too.
The reason why, this is easy to say, I only care about the truth, but the reason I'm saying this is it could turn out that having religion of some sort in a society is beneficial because the vast majority of people needs that kind of compass and orientation and value system. It doesn't bother me if this were true, because on the one hand, it wouldn't show that it's therefore true. It sometimes, untrue opinions or theories can be more socially beneficial, right? It could also be we talked earlier about what kind of cost benefit analysis would, in terms of punishment, or what kind of threat of deterrence would be effective for different people in society. It could also be that, maybe most people in society need religion to be cooperative and cohesive and compliant, but maybe some don't. And thirdly, I also think that there are certain places that are quite cohesive and high trust and very low in religion. So, I mean, this is kind of cheap to bring this up, but often people talk about Scandinavia and so on as Northern Europe. Just anecdotally, people around me are nice. And I don't think I've even ever met a person of faith in my life. It's very rare. I mean, people baptize their children sometimes, but it's sort of like, yeah. I've never heard anyone say I believe in straight up. But everyone is, perfectly well adjusted and good person to be around.
Yeah. The question is whether that'll persist for the next few generations.
Exactly.
But I'm curious, where did you grow up?
I'm German. So I grew up in a small town close to Frankfurt, so in the center of Germany. And my parents are from Düsseldorf, where I live now. This is sort of the Rhineland area, so very western Germany, close to the Dutch border. So like Dawkins, I would refer to myself as a cultural Christian, right? Evidently, I grew up in a country where the culture is Christian. I celebrate Christmas, for instance, and Easter, and there are churches around and so on. So culturally, yes, but I didn't grow up, as a participant.
But you don't know anyone who is.
I don't really think so. No.
Wow, fascinating. Well, I spent 66 years growing up in America, where religion is obviously more prevalent.
Where are you from, if I may ask?
I grew up a lot of different places. But I'm a Jew, which makes my role in a more Christian country a little bit more complicated.
Yeah,
but I know I have known many Christians, mm-hmm. many religious people. So it's just fascinating to me that, and here I live in Israel, where I know an even larger number.
Yeah,
they tend to be limited to a couple of faiths.
Israel is a kind of young and modern country. I suppose there are many people who, do the rituals, I suppose, and are culturally Jewish, but maybe they don't really believe in the Old Testament, right?
Well, I could give the answer of often attributed, probably not correctly, to either. Sometimes I hear it about Niels Bohr, or I hear it about Fermi. It's probably been told about Einstein. The student walks into his office, and as he's leaving, he sees a horseshoe over the door. And he says, Professor Fermi, you don't really believe in that, do you? He says, oh, of course not. But they say it works even if you don't believe in it. Now, what it really means to be a believer, I know lots of true believers in Judaism. I would put my own faith in a more complicated frame that I would struggle to put into words. But there certainly are people both in any faith who go through the motions, or who like the camaraderie for many, many reasons.
Yeah, sure.
But there are there are believers. And when you say, do they believe in the Old Testament? I'd say there are a lot of Christians and Jews who think it happened more or less the way it's described, and it's worth keeping many of the strictures that are in there. But let's move on. Let's talk about agriculture, which I find extremely interesting as an economist. You have a section called The Greatest Mistake of All Time. Some people argue that agriculture was a terrible turn in the human history. Why? And what's the justification for that claim? And do you agree with that? You have a more nuanced view, but
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether I agree with it, and I've never had a firm view on this, because I'm not sure what the criteria for evaluating that would be. And let me explain what I mean by that. So the phrase comes from Jared Diamond. Jared Diamond is a famous author who, you know, wrote many famous books, but Guns, Germs, and Steel made a huge impression on, it was a massive bestseller, and it's a great book. I don't know if that one still holds up in light of the evidence, but it's still recommended, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Which also explains certain global inequalities in economic development, or you know how some places got a head start, sort of. And he coined this phrase: the worst mistake of humanity was the invention of agriculture. Now, I think what this means, and this seems to me to be largely accepted in the people who study archaeology and the Neolithic period and the transition from essentially the nomadic hunter-gatherer lifestyle that human beings were engaging in for the whole Pleistocene, you know, 2 million-ish years. And then there was a switch. People used to think it was 10,000 years ago, maybe 11, maybe 12,000 years ago. Maybe at one point we'll realize it was 15,000 years ago. Who knows? Certain climatic upheavals probably happened that enabled new forms of living, and then human beings who are constantly experimenting figured it out, and that turned out to be the successful variant, to become sedentary, to figure out seasons and planting crops and irrigation and building larger and larger buildings and living closer together, domesticating animals, and so on and so on. Now, this turned out to be the successful model because it also amplified military capability, right? So all the other people who wanted to remain hunter-gatherers, they were just killed or absorbed by this new model. And probably the populations that we know today as hunter-gatherers are not some sort of remnants of a primitive lifestyle. They probably, as some people sometimes say, they probably live in a post-apocalyptic world where a huge empire destroyed their life. Right, so contemporary hunter-gatherers are sort of the people who, you know, the very few people who escaped this absorption by the cultural evolution of empires a couple thousand years ago. This same dynamic happened in East Asia in various places somewhat later, but analogous happened in Middle America in populations there. And so you keep seeing that, but to my knowledge, the earliest is in Mesopotamia. And why is it supposed to be the worst mistake of all time? And I think the argument is that it was a terrible deal for the vast majority of people, right? You were able to create an economic surplus via agriculture, storing calories, essentially. So people had a higher calorie input, perhaps, but it came with oppression. It came with very, very hard labor. It came with slavery. It came with huge inequality. It came with warfare and terror. It came with diseases, because for the first time, people lived around animals a lot, and you get these zoonotic pandemics. And so at the very least, it seems to have been a terrible deal for the majority of people, maybe not for everyone, but for the majority. And people now think that the nomadic hunter-gatherer lifestyle had certain downsides, but overall it wasn't so bad. Human beings always had relatively high child mortality. That has to do with the big head, right?
Yeah.
And various other things. So we always had that. But once people made it past 4 or 5 years old, life was apparently pretty good, right? People, they were 60, 70 years old in many cases.
Yeah.
There weren't many diseases. They didn't really have cancer. They didn't really have, you know, most diseases. They didn't really have the flu, perhaps even, because that is an animal virus. And they were telling stories. They didn't have long work days, you know, not unusually long. At least that's what we now believe. So compared to hunter-gatherer life, the transition to early empires was a terrible development for the vast majority of people. And it's only somewhat recently that life became better for many people again.
Yes, I don't agree with that. I think it's
All right.
You know, it's an empirical question, obviously, and it's hard to answer. But listeners may remember Yuval Harari on the program. He's also thinks it's a mistake. We had a conversation mm-hmm. about that. You can go back and listen to it. We'll link to it. Rachel Lawden, a food historian mm-hmm. who's been a guest on the program, has a different view. I don't know if we talked about it when we talked about the history of food. I think we probably did. But the only thing I want to interject here on this dispute is that Margaret Mead did a fairly successful job in romanticizing primitive mm-hmm. Economies and primitive peoples who are effectively hunter-gatherers. Others have come along, and I'm blanking on the name. I'll remember it, and we'll put a link to it. Others have suggested that she was wrong. Gathering enough protein in much of human history as a hunter-gatherer was extremely difficult, and life was very, very hard. It was not a short work week, and people struggled to stay alive. So that's an empirical question. I don't know. But it's just sort of an interesting question. But for you, the importance, putting aside whether it was a good turn for mm-hmm. or dark, near dead end for humans, it had an effect on morality because of the stationarity and the potential for advancing divisional labor, which small hunter-gatherer societies are never going to have a significant amount of divisional labor.
Yeah.
And you recognize, I think quite eloquently in the book, quite spectacularly, the role of trust and cooperation, which enables a modern economy that has overwhelmingly been beneficial for most measures of material well-being, even if there was a long time when it wasn't so great in the agricultural period, if that's your take.
Yeah, yeah. So that's right. I mean, this is an interesting question. You're right, it's empirical. I think for a long time, the view of what we would now describe as hunter-gatherer populations was a kind of like, these are savages and they are uncivilized. That was then overcome and overcorrected in a way by people like Mead, who said, no, this was all kumbaya right? And then the pendulum swings back and people say, well, that seems to be a little bit like a sort of like civilizational guilt, and you're kind of like trying to... So it wasn't all fine. It was actually hard work, and the diet was at least very unsteady. I think people still believe that, right? So sometimes you would have a huge kill and then you're fine for a couple of days, right? But then there are periods of scarcity and so on and so on.
And we killed off all the big animals that made that relatively pleasant. So there was this post-extinction period where hunter-gathering must have been catching a lot of squirrels, and that's not much protein. I think that's the issue.
Exactly. And all of that, I'm not sure about the details, but conditionally, I would be happy to grant that. And still, the transition to agriculture could have been even worse than that, right?
Where
you have like grinding oppression and
famine, drought.
Exactly. And you just get absolutely murdered building the pyramids, right? Yeah. That sort of stuff. Well, it seems to me that at least in terms of, like I said, disease and oppression, I would be surprised if there hadn't been more of that with the emergence of civilization.
Agreed.
Also, a certain type of warfare I mean, there's always been out-group violence and, like we said, raids, and people were, you know, competing for resources with violence. And sometimes people just being, you know, hostile for no good reason even, other than these people look different. So we find that, and you also have some things that's why it's so difficult to evaluate. So was it, all things considered, a mistake or not? Because you also have certain types of economic development that only become possible this way.
Yeah.
Right?
Correct.
You cannot have the fruits of a modern economy if you, first and foremost, you need a large number of people, right? Yeah. There are fascinating studies about populations from Australia and New Zealand where there are no differences between them other than population size. And in New Zealand, the populations, they couldn't sustain bows and arrows. They only had very, very primitive boats. They lost almost all their tools, not because they were stupid, right? Not because they were genetically inferior. They're literally identical to Australians. It's just that they got stuck on this island and it was too few people, and you can't sustain a certain type of technology and cooperation if you have 20,000 people, right? So that's why I always find it hilarious when you have like the Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones or these shows, and you have like evidently a society, you know, where everyone is kind of in the army and no one, there's no economy, right? There's sort of like, you need millions of people. And like the Lord of the Rings, I'm not sure, but there are like 100,000 humans or something in Middle Earth, and they have essentially like a kind of like medieval civilization, which is just not possible, right? Yeah. You can't have anything. You can't have armor and huge cities and castles with 100,000 people. You have nothing, right? And so, of course, this is a fantasy novel, but I'm just saying...
Yeah.
Population size matters a lot. Yeah. And this kind of the emergence of civilizations and urban living, indeed, only made that possible. And then it still took a couple thousand years until the real escape from the Malthusian trap started to work. And that's just like 300 years ago when that started, right? That's very recent.
So we're going to shift gears here. But before I do, I want to read a paragraph that is really magnificent. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on it. It just stands on its own. There are more interesting paragraphs in the book, but this was the most eloquent, and I'm just going to read it.
I'm curious to hear.
Quote, you're talking about the modern era, modern times. You say, quote, this is a time when many are freed from the yoke of hard labor and can decide who they want to be and where they want to live. It is an age when the sweet fruits from distant lands, once so rare and unattainable that even the rich knew them only from paintings in the salons of the even richer, are at hand at any time, when the dream of flying has come true, and when the hearts of strangers can beat in the chests of those once destined to die. End of quote. That's just magnificent writing.
Thank you.
And there's some good jokes in here too, which I'm not going to ruin and read them out loud. But I want to close with a question that hangs over the last, I don't know, maybe 20% of the book. Mm-hmm. And the book was written in, was published first in 2023. Mm-hmm. Shocking how much has happened in the world in the last two plus years.
Oh yeah.
I'd say in the current edition, the book is guardedly optimistic about our potential to continue to make progress. I want you to defend the idea that we have made progress. And some of the examples are undeniable of progress, the way we treat women, the way we treat the world treats women, the way the world treats people of color, the death of slavery, they're more or less, or at least a dramatic reduction. Mm-hmm. Sexual preferences are more tolerated. There are many, many beautiful and positive things that have happened to the human narrative in the last few hundred years. But other things have happened that are not so good. Yeah. And I often spar with guests because it's easy to forget the bad things. I'm just going to pick one. The family is not doing well, the so-called family. Mm-hmm. And many people celebrate that. And maybe they're right. I'm agnostic. That's not true. I'm not agnostic. I think the family is important. And I think that the death of the family is troubling and is a contributor to some of the things we're seeing in the world around us. But mm-hmm. Whether you agree with that or not, mm-hmm. it feels in January of 2026 like the world is in a very unhealthy equilibrium that is only moving to an unhealthier one. Mm-hmm. And morality or human well-being, even though I, as an economist, think material well-being is quite dramatically better for billions of people, actually. Mm-hmm. It is troubling to me that our ability to, I'll just call it our ability to get along, seems mm-hmm. to be in jeopardy. We mm-hmm. see that in America. Mm-hmm. We saw it in many parts of Europe, certainly in England, struggling with Brexit and post-Brexit issues. Are you optimistic? Make the case for why we're on the right trajectory, even though there's some ups and downs along the way.
Yeah.
Because I've become agnostic. I used to be
that's
an optimist.
Great.
I'm less so today.
Yeah, totally, totally. I think about that too. I think about that too. And I do agree. I think, so actually the English version, we're still working copy editing that in 24, and we did make some changes already. Uh-huh. So it's very slightly, but even some examples that I give are toned down or even less optimistic. So we already had to kind of like adjust away from that a little bit. I did become interested in that question of progress. You're right. We forget some bad things, but we forget some good things, but we also forget some bad things. And there's been this trend in thinking about the past and about society over the past 10 years or so, where people try to say, really, things are better now than they seem, right? Yeah, this sort of like optimism.
Yeah.
So you did have Angus Deaton, for instance, an economist who said, you know, health and wealth, they improve. You had famously Steven Pinker, social scientists such as Hans Rosling. And I have a whole library of optimism like
Me
that,
too.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that was necessary too, to avoid that kind of like nostalgia and doomerism about everything's always going to hell, right?
Yep.
I think that is a useful corrective as well. So I'm still kind of temperamentally on board with trying to be optimistic. And I think there's negativity bias in headlines. Yeah. You know, suicide numbers only get reported when they tick up, right? Even when their long-term trend is down, whatever, that kind of example.
Yeah.
So I'm still mostly on board with that. At the same time, you're right that the optimistic tone that people like Pinker had, or that I have in the book a little bit, is a little more awkward now. And I do think that essentially, well, pretty much exactly the past 10 years have brought certain changes that are don't point in a direction that I think is great. I tend to think that Brexit was the first real big event that ushered in this atmosphere of returning to a kind of ethno-nationalist thinking about politics, groups, culture, and the economy. Yeah. It was always a silly idea that, you know, an isolated British economy would function better. That this is not really even a possibility, right? This has always been a cultural vibe kind of thing. You had the same thing with various right-wing, neoconservative backlash kind of movements in the Netherlands, Hungary, in Germany, Austria, France, and so on and so on and so on, where people also said, we do not like many of the things that are happening due to essentially the global integration of institutions and the economy. This can be migration. It can be changes in the labor market and unemployment and so on and so on. I think part of that is understandable. It does suck when your job appears, right? Well, it's an entirely different question whether, in terms of running an economy of 50 million or 500 people, that cost doesn't have to be accepted. Well, easy for us to say, perhaps, but it's a tricky question. But we have seen these movements, right? We have seen the election of Donald Trump makes it about one person, but it's more and more, and I think increasingly we see that it's also a cultural normative shift in the erosion and or destruction of certain norms of decorum and the way people treat each other. Yeah. I always, every couple of years, people share this video of the presidential debate between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. And it's a different country.
Shocking, yeah.
Right? It's these guys, they spent 5 minutes each on stage and say, this guy is my best friend. I love him. Yeah. Right? And I cannot praise the accomplishments of Mr. Obama. And they're hugging and kissing, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's just unthinkable, even a couple of years later. And certainly today, that may be gone forever. I mean, we don't know that, but that's not something that I think is likely to be good. And so I would tone down the optimistic message a little bit. Now, when we talk about long-term trends, you have this or that guy, you have whatever whatever representative of this or that party that is short-sighted or vicious or both. But I still want to think about general trends in more optimistic terms, because I do think that these trends, you know, let's put our own country first, let's run our own economy with our own interests in mind, let's be more homogenous and so on and so on. I don't really think they are functional in the world that we live in. I do think the trend still goes towards scaling up cooperation even more. And these, I'm inclined to think, are sort of growing pains of that. I hope that these growing pains don't become so large that people tear it all down and destroy things. That is kind of, in a way, what happened in the 30s in Germany, right? Where things were happening and it created a moment that could be exploited by people who were, well, lucky from their point of view, right? So opportunistically lucky in exploiting a kind of sentiment in a noteworthy part of the population, and it managed, and it allowed them to wreak havoc. Doesn't even, doesn't even seem adequate, but just catastrophic consequences for the huge numbers of people. So hopefully that's not the path that we're on, even though there's always that risk, I think, that can happen. So there's no Whiggishness or naivety, I hope, in the story that I'm inclined to tell. But I think that if I had to guess, the forces are still pushing in a direction of, you know, it doesn't really make sense to hate each other because your eyes look different or your skin is darker or lighter or whatever. And there can be cultural diversity without antagonism, and there can be tolerance for plural ways of living and so on and so on. But then again, I'm a 42-year-old man now, so this is these are my values, and you know, now you have a bunch of 25-year-olds who grew up on toxic internet content and they disagree. But if you ask me, you know, Hanno Sauer, right now, this is my answer.
My guest today has been Hanno Sauer. His book is The Invention of Good and Evil. Hanno, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thank you so much. It was great fun.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.